Welcome to the Ephesiology Podcast and a bonus episode in our series, Archaeology Meets Missiology, the Mission of God and the Records of Time. Today we have Michigan Cooper, our resident ephesiologist, and I'm Andrew Johnson in Victoria, British Columbia, and we have a groundbreaking podcast to get to. Michael, nothing like flubbing the intro. Well, this is kind of an exciting deal. Are you ready to record this intro? Are you ready to have some of the things that you have been sitting on fully able to be released into the world for people to see, for people to hear about?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in spite of the flub intro,
I'll take it.
I think so. It's kind of, it's hard to know what I feel at the moment. And of course, you never want to make things bigger than what they are. But yeah, this was kind of exciting. And I'm excited about it because it's shedding some light on one of my favorite gospels. I guess all four are my favorite gospels, sure, but this one in particular. And it's shedding more light on the city of Ephesus, which, as you know, is my favorite
New Testament city. I think we have a track record here.
Yeah. So in that sense, it's kind of fun to be able to talk about these things and I don't want to exaggerate what we're talking about, but to make a big revelation about the city of Ephesus and one of the gospels. So.
Oh my goodness. Well, I hope that you, listener and or viewer, are a little excited by what you're hearing. I hope we've teased it enough. I don't want us to ruin the surprise. So this is an intro that Michael is giving a revelation to some research that he has been doing. And I hope that you enjoy where the road leads. And so we will catch you on the backside of the content of this podcast.
So we're at the Bulletarian. Again, as Chink had said, this is the place where all of the city officials would have gathered. The town clerk would be here, and others who would have made up the town council, the boule. And next to the Bulletarian is this area that's called the Prytanean. As I mentioned before, this was moved, this was erected here during the time of Augustus Caesar. So the end of the first century BC, early first century AD, when he moved the focal point of religion from the Temple of Artemis to this area. So this area would have, well, it did become the central point of the civic life and the religious life of Ephesus. It had several different offices. One is a prytanis. It's usually translated as the president, not meaning that he's the president of the entire city, but the president of the civic religious functions. President might not be the best word for it, but I don't know if we have any other word that's any better than that. But the prytanis, then there would be the curetes that we talked about earlier, the guardians of Artemis. There would be priests as well as hymn singers. These columns and along the walls here served as archives of all of these people. So we can't, unfortunately, get close enough here, but when I was here the last time, I had the privilege to be able to walk in there and photograph all of the inscriptions on the columns and around the base here. And it's just full of people's names, one after another. usually in an order. It would give us the president's name first, and then who were the Choretes and the priests and the hymn singers afterwards. What's interesting about this is not only that it's the civic center and the religious center of Ephesus, but the names that are on there. When I first came a couple years ago and took a photograph and began to study the inscription, I came across the name in the genitive form of Theophilus. And I thought, wow, that is super interesting, because we don't know who Theophilus is. The scholars for forever have been debating about who this person is. Is he an actual person? Is it just simply a reference to people who love God, which is the literal translation of his name, Theophilus? Is he somebody else? Or does he not exist at all? And he's just created out of Luke's imagination. Well, when I came across that inscription, it was compelling. And so I went on the search for this Theophilus to see if there might be any other evidence for him. On our second trip with Toby, we found his name again in the inscription gallery over here. But it was outside of the date. And it was a little bit disappointing for me, because I was so desperate for Theophilus to be here. But that didn't deter me. I'm like a pit bull. I hang on to things until I can't hang on any longer. And that was the case with this Theophilus. So on the third trip, as I was photographing all of the inscriptions here, at the very top, the lintel block, there is written the name of a person named Tiberius Claudius something or another that gives us a date of when that would have been put in place. Sometime during the reign of Claudius, which was exactly the time of the Apostle Paul, from the early 50s until 54. So Paul would have been here when that lintel block would have been erected, which means that all of the column below it was in place as well. What's interesting is the second line under the name of the Prytanis, Tiberius Claudius, whoever else his name was the name Theophilus, the name that corresponds with the exact date that the Apostle Paul was here. And that was super fascinating to me. For obvious reasons, if we could connect Theophilus to this area, then we could begin to make some interesting observations about Luke's gospel. And so I started to do that after I did a study of Theophilus's name. His name, some scholars think, was very popular. But as near as we can tell, in a rather extensive inscription catalog, his name, yes, is documented many times, but very few instances in the city of Ephesus. In fact, I think, if I remember correctly, there aren't as many as 10 references, and they span a time period from well before Christ and a few years after the time that the Apostle Paul would be here. There is one inscription, or I should say two inscriptions, one on a coin, so a numismatic reference, to a person named Theophilus that falls within the date range of the time that the Apostle Paul was here. And then this inscription here. And so that is a compelling piece of evidence that perhaps Theophilus is from Ephesus. Where that moved me next was asking the question, well, if Theophilus is from Ephesus and Luke is writing to this Theophilus, do the stories line up? Well, I began to see that they were lining up. First off, Luke addresses Theophilus as the most excellent. That was a title that was given to a prominent civic leader. And so him being on this lintel block in the civic and religious center of a very important city, that title would fit with the Theophilus that we're looking for, this Theophilus of Ephesus. But that's not enough to go on. Next, I began to study the book of the Gospel of Luke. And without going into a lot of kind of nerdy detail that Josh likes, I'll just share briefly. We have in the New Testament studies a theory that's called the four-source document hypothesis. That simply means that the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, which all follow a similar geographic journey, similar stories progressively through the life of Jesus, have four sources to them. Mark was the original source for the other two Gospels, Matthew and Luke. There is another source that both Luke and Matthew use that Mark does not use that we call Q, or Quella, meaning source. It's a completely hypothetical source. There's no written document that's labeled Q or anything like that. It's just a list of sayings that Matthew and Luke both have in common. And then Matthew has unique information that neither Mark or Luke have, and Luke has unique information that neither Mark or Matthew have. That's called the L source. So I began to look and see, are there things in that L source that line up with a Theophilus who might have been from the city of Ephesus? And as I was hoping, I began to see it. Remember, I talked about the Prytanis, the Caretas, the priests, and the hymn singers. On that lintel block, Theophilus is called a Caretas, a guardian of Artemis, a very important position in the worship of Artemis. You remember I said that in that procession every year in celebration of her birth, it was led by hymn singers. They would be singing praises to Artemis. And so the first piece of evidence that the Gospel of Luke was directed to Theophilus of Ephesus was the hymns that are included in Luke that are not included in any other gospel. And there are four of them. There is the hymn of Zacharias, the priest who's a relative of Mary. There's the hymn of Mary. There's the hymn of the angels and the hymn of Simeon. All in praise of Jesus. And so when we talk about this idea of missiological parallelisms, you begin to get this picture that here Luke is really trying to connect the story of Jesus to Theophilus. He would have absolutely understood why hymns were being sung to a god, because he did it every year in procession to the celebration of the birth of Artemis. And here Luke is telling these stories of the singing of hymns to Jesus as a way to connect with Theophilus. To me, that became the most convincing piece of evidence that Theophilus of Ephesus is the same Theophilus that Luke writes to in his gospel and then in the book of Acts. And I don't know if I'm right or not. I hope I am. But there has been no other plausible theory in New Testament scholarship to suggest who exactly Theophilus is. But I think this is who he is. What is neat about that is that now we know something about who this person was, Theophilus. He was an individual. He was somebody very important in this city, somebody who understood the religious significance of what it meant to worship a god or a goddess. And Luke engaged with him. And if you can imagine going down this street every year while the Apostle Paul is here, Theophilus would have been a part of leading that procession. And there is no doubt in my mind that Paul would have known this Theophilus, as he would have others on that column. Now, that's the compelling evidence for Theophilus of Ephesus, being the recipient of Luke's gospel as well as the book of Acts. But there's some additional information that makes the story, I think, even a bit more compelling. And that is the mention of two other people on these columns, actually on the same column, dated at the exact same time as Theophilus here. We have the name of Tyrannus and Trophimus. This Tyrannus, I believe, is the Tyrannus from the Hall of Tyrannus. It fits everything we know about lecture halls in this area. It was not unusual for a religious person to actually have a lecture hall in their home. We're going to see an example of this. And so it is not outside of reason to think that the Hall of Tyrannus was a hall of this particular Tyrannus. This is the only Tyrannus that fits the description and the time period with Luke, with Acts chapter 19. The only one out of all of the Tyrannoi, if we will, that we know about in Ephesus. So I'm fairly confident as I am about Theophilus of Ephesus, that this is the Tyrannus of the school or the hall of Tyrannus. He was also a Cretes. He would have been friends with Theophilus. And that perhaps explains why Luke doesn't go into a lot of detail about the Hall of Tyrannus in Acts 19. Theophilus knew about it. He was friends already with Tyrannus. He would have known very well where that lecture hall was, so he didn't need to go into that detail. But there's that third person, Trophimus. Trophimus is a priest listed on this, same time period as the other two. Trophimus, we know, becomes a disciple, a follower of Christ, and he becomes a part of Paul's team, if you will. Paul's team was probably more than 20 people from Asia Minor by the time of his ministry or during the time of his ministry here. And Trophimus, we know, was mentioned a couple times, not only as a list of those who accompanied Paul, but he accompanies Paul to Jerusalem. And you might remember in Acts 21 that an incident occurs when Paul arrives in Jerusalem. And he is told by the elders, you know, you need to go and pay homage or tax to the temple. And Paul had no problem with that. And so he went to the temple to pay that tax. And apparently he took with him, among others, a person named Trophimus. And do you remember the Jewish response? Yeah, I mean, that was the beginning point of Paul's travels ultimately to Rome. They were absolutely upset that they brought a Gentile into the temple. Now think about that. Trophimus was a priest of Artemis. It would have absolutely outraged the Jews in Jerusalem that Paul would have brought a former priest of Artemis into the Jewish temple. And so it makes a lot of sense. And there are other scholars that agree, that we agree, that this is the Trophimus of Acts chapter 20 and 21, and later in 2 Timothy chapter 4. And so we have three names, same time period, Theophilus, Tyrannus, Trophimus, three disciples, faithful followers of Christ, that factor prominently in the city of Ephesus. And that has given me pause to ask the question of all of us as we're thinking about engaging in our contexts. What is our relationship with the civic and religious leaders in our community? Because I think the New Testament example is that we must have those relationships, that those are important. They might cause some anxiety. Perhaps they might be difficult, but boy, is there any more of a difficult place than this was in the first century? And we have to think about that. The other thing it gives me pause to consider is thinking about Luke's gospel and his engagement with Theophilus. It wasn't a three circles, It wasn't the camel method. It wasn't, you know, the four spiritual laws. It was 24 chapters of telling the story of Jesus in ways that connected with Theophilus. That should encourage us that our efforts might take 24 chapters to explain the entire story of who Jesus is before somebody will change their lives. And I think Theophilus does. When we get to Acts chapter 1 and Luke continues that story, it's no longer most excellent Theophilus. Now it's, oh, Theophilus. And I can just imagine Luke going up to Theophilus saying, oh, Theophilus, I want to tell you the rest of the story. This is what happened after Jesus rose from the dead and was ascended to the throne. This is how the story continues. And now you're a part of that story. And that should be an encouragement to all of us who are believers. We're a part of that story with Theophilus, with Tyrannus, and with Trophimus.
Okay, Michael. You just said the thing. You just told the world all about Luke, his connection to Theophilus, his connection to Ephesus, and what this could mean. I think it's huge. I think it's really huge for the person who isn't steeped in academia, archaeology, missiology, or any of the other fun words that we like to throw about. What do you see as the significance of being able to tie Theophilus to Ephesus and Luke?
Yeah, well, you know, I think there are a couple, of course. I mentioned them in the video, but just to reiterate, I think first for me, I think it's super cool that we can say that we know something about a person. And a person in the New Testament, and for that, I love that Luke is writing to Theophilus, and we know something about who he is. We know something about his family. We know something about what he did in Ephesus, and in fact, we know a lot of detail about what he did in Ephesus, and that's cool. You know, I think. Modern day jargon says we see him now, mm-hmm. You know, and so Theophilus isn't just somebody, this isn't a name written in two New Testament books, but he's a person and an individual, somebody really who was seeking and trying to understand, somebody who was devout in another religious tradition, and yet he was open to learning and understanding and exploring, and Luke does that with him, and so I think that's really cool.
I think it's amazing. One of the things that I appreciated from the video that you highlighted, right? So I'm not breaking new ground. You are the groundbreaker. I just enjoy it. Is it helps us to reframe, or rather put a new lens on when we read Luke's gospel. So we come to the text of Luke now understanding this is what Luke was thinking because he was trying to make this make sense for Theophilus. Luke was trying to make, he's making these specific points for a reader from Ephesus with this background. So to read Luke through that, as you highlight some of the hymns, right? And there's a reason that these are showing up in this context. It really does make it come alive. It doesn't make it just a general post to all lovers of God everywhere who are going to read this and, you know, be edified. It's Luke saying to somebody that might be a friend, right? Hey, man.
Yeah.
I want you to know him, and I'm going to tell you about Jesus in such a way that you are passionate, that you care, that you are excited, and it's going to make sense to you. I think that's masterful.
Yeah. And I agree, obviously. And I think that's among the several points that are answering that question about why this is important. And you know, we have a kind of a understanding in New Testament studies or in scriptural studies or in hermeneutics in general. And hermeneutics is just simply the kind of the scientific study of literature, whatever mm-hmm. piece of literature it is, that we need to know the context. And we need, and a part of that is knowing the audience. And for so long, and I think this is true of the Gospel of John as well, for so long, we've just looked at John and Luke and said, well, you know, to be honest, the context isn't that important. We can apply this in John's case to any sort of metropolitan, you know, important mm-hmm. center. And in Luke's case, we can apply this, you know, to any Gentile audience. Mm-hmm. And I still think that's true. I think there's application for those. But just as you mentioned, knowing specifically the context and the audience that these gospels are being written to just illuminates them in new ways. And that's important for our understanding of the text. But I think it's also important for us in terms of how we conceptualize our engagement with other people. And I yes. mentioned in the video, mm-hmm. you know, Luke takes 24 chapters to tell the story of Jesus. And in the Western world, and this has bled over into the mission world as well, we are so fascinated with numbers and production and the rapid responses
right.
that we've reduced, you know, Luke's 24 chapters of explanation to three circles or four spiritual laws or, you know, whatever evangelistic method is in vogue these days. And I think what Luke is showing us is that it's important for us to take our time to tell the story, to get that story right. I mean, Luke is an exceptional historian. He's meticulous in what he's writing down, and he's done his research. He has interviewed eyewitnesses and so on. And I think we need to recover the depth of our evangelistic methods and look at Luke as an example of that.
And I think in addition to, so, you know, full stop, hit period on your thought, I echo all of it entirely. Again, this is a, just even with this revelation, is a slow down, closer look at what Luke says. Okay, I want this person to know Jesus, and he is from a far different context. And so he is doing the work. He is doing missionary work, right? The what we talk about training. I mean, I'm thinking of Steve Lestin, right? You move into a different culture, and what's the first question you ask? What do they need? Why is Jesus good news for them? And so we look at Luke now, knowing or believing your research that Theophilus is from Ephesus. And so we look through that lens and we say, okay, so what questions are Luke, what questions does Luke seek to answer? What is he trying to say is, I am telling you this because this specific thing is the answer to the question of why is Jesus good news to the Ephesian context? Why is Jesus good news for a leader in the court? Why is Jesus good news for a hymn singer, right? Like what does this matter to you, Theophilus? So beyond just the evangelistic benefit that is clearly there and should be focused on, it's also the watching the mind of the missionary, watching that missiological focus come out to bear, I think is so good.
Yeah, well, I love that. In essence, what Luke is doing is he is answering actual questions that Theophilus has. Mm-hmm. And so much of our evangelism today is answering questions that nobody's asking. And we're doing that because, you know, we want a quick response. We need to see conversions. Of course, some of this is driven by somebody's theology. But what I love about Luke and the time that he takes is that he is genuinely addressing the questions that Theophilus has. And that should compel us as well, as we're sitting in conversations with people, not just simply cramming down a gospel presentation, but taking the time to listen, to get to know that person, to hear the questions that they have, and then making those connections. You know, how is Jesus good news in this context? And Luke just beautifully does that.
I think we could probably go on a longer tangent here. There is the advantage of that relational-based evangelism. And unfortunately, oftentimes I have heard when people talk about relational-based evangelism, it still comes off with, like, you need to be able to have an understanding of the other person. But it still almost feels like a bait and switch. Even the best stuff on relational evangelism is, and you need to establish a relationship so that when you finally have a chance to tell them the gospel, ha, you've got it, and they know you, and you know them, and you can do so. But when I'm hearing you talk about how Luke is thinking towards Theophilus, I am not hearing establish a relationship so that you can at the right moment insert this gospel message. It is Luke loves Theophilus. Luke has not, he doesn't just have a relationship. He is close. And so because he loves his friend, he understands, man, I want to tell you the best news. And I see your questions. I see what you are asking. And I'm not going to give you the pat answer that I have researched and made ready. And now I have this presentation to give you. It's friends who are talking. And it was like, oh, this matters to you. This matters to you. You care about this. Well, I'm excited to let you know this is also what I care about. And I want you to know that there are answers, and this is who I know, and this is what I know, and this is how I know it. And that seems so much different than just, again, relational evangelism, right? It's just like, no, these are friends who love each other and are in deep relationship. And out of that healthy relationship, one says, I have these questions, and the other says, oh man, I know, let me tell you, in a very ordered and researched manner.
I mean, we want to be careful not to overstate, but I think you're right. I think it's evident that Luke and Theophilus do have this sort of relationship, and that's so important when we're engaging with people, not just to do it, as you said, for a bait and switch. And I think it's also important for us to recognize that, you know, the Christian life permeates who Luke is. I mean, this is just who he is. And there's something of that that is presumably attractive to Theophilus. Otherwise, he wouldn't be coming to Luke and asking for him to recount this story. And that's kind of cool. Yeah, you know, it's also kind of cool, the other relationship connections here. There's this, I'll throw out this kind of geeky word or two words that we use when we're doing these sorts of studies in archaeology, and we can do it in textual studies as well. But there's a methodology that we call onomatic congruence. Onoma is the Greek word for name, and so onomastic is using looking at the study of names and the congruency of those names in particular social contexts or civic contexts or whatever. And we see that here, which is super exciting, because what it does is it raises the plausibility that if names are associated with each other, that they're also associated with certain events. And in this case, of course, as I mentioned in the video, we have three names that appear on that column in Ephesus. Of course, Theophilus, but also Tyrannus and Trophimus. And three people mentioned in the New Testament, the names all appearing on the same column, dated at the same time period, all within the same social kind of bracket, if you will. They're civic leaders, religious leaders. And so all of those kind of add up to giving more plausibility to the theory that Theophilus is from Ephesus. But more importantly, and I think, you know, on a human level, I can just imagine the three of them getting together. You know, if Paul is going to the Hall of Tyrannus and Theophilus knows Tyrannus, there's a good chance that Theophilus was also going to hear Paul at the Hall of Tyrannus, and Trophimus as well. And we know Trophimus ultimately travels with Paul, and I tell that story a little bit in the video. But those that human element here, I think, is really cool to think about, that there are friendships or networks, and it helps us to think about, you know, who are the people in our lives that we're connected with, that we can share these stories with, the stories about Jesus. How can we sit and be their friends and listen to their challenges and struggles, their successes and so on, and begin to make those connecting points to say, you know, here's where Jesus is the good news. And just kind of cool stuff.
Just kind of cool stuff. Well, this is going to be some of the things that we just watched in the video and that you and I have been talking about are a part of a book that is going to be forthcoming. What is the title of your forthcoming book?
Well, it's no longer forthcoming. It has come.
Hey-o.
Yeah. It's called Gods, Emperors, Philosophers, and a New Movement: Discovering the Movement of God in the Archaeological Record of Asia Minor. You always have to have a long subtitle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
More things to search for.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the book is out by Wipfenstock and available on Amazon in paperback now, as well as in a digital format. And I'm excited for the book to be out and for people to be reading it, and looking forward to interacting with folks on the things in the book. And because I think it is, you know, at least in the area of missiology, it's an area that we haven't given a lot of attention to. And so for that, I'm excited to be able to help missiologists and missionaries to think more deeply about what was going on in the early centuries of the church, and what did it look like then? And we can practically see in the material culture evidence for the Christian movement, and thinking about the implications for that in the way in which we do missions. And so it's as much of a book on archaeology as it is on missiology, and trying to move us to the practical. You know, the question that you so often love to ask, so what? Why is this important? And I address that so what question in each of the chapters.
And in addition to Michael just writing a book and, again, putting out some really incredible thoughts into the world of theology and academia, as well as now archaeology, because no field is safe from Michigan Cooper. you've also done something which I think is great, which is there are resources that are available as a part of this book in addition to just the book. If people are purchasing the book, what are some of the things they can also be excited about?
Yeah, two things. One is that we have a corresponding course that goes along with the book, where we'll put these videos and other videos of the sites in Asia Minor that we've been studying. as well as some other information that just takes it to the next level, I think, of depth. And so for those who really want to dive more deeply into the study of Asia Minor and the archaeological record and the implications that those hold for missions today, it's a great resource. And it's completely free for those who purchase the book. There's a QR code there for people to scan and a coupon code to get the course for free. And inside that course, there's another resource, and that's a book that I pulled together of photographs, 116 photographs of the things that I talk about in the book. So if you have the book and you're seeing, you know, references to different figures in each of the chapters, that resource of those figures is available for free. And you know, I decided to do that because I can't believe people are actually buying the paperback book. It's $35.
Why are you dissuading them? Don't dissuade them. Invite them. It's a wonderful use of your 35 American dollars, or slightly more if you're Canadian or in other parts of the world. So don't dissuade them. It's great.
Well, it was going to be more like $70 if I would have included the pictures in it. Mm. And so instead of doing that, I decided to do it in a digital format. And so those are available as a free ebook download. That's in the course as well. And they're great pictures. They really turned out super well. I'm very surprised, actually. And I give explanations on each of the photographs and so on. So it just adds a little bit more flavor, if you will, or content color to the book itself.
Now, missing from these photos is a photo of Megan and I sitting in front of the amphitheater in Ephesus. So I'm sorry to all of you readers that you will not get that very much blurry, out of focus photo from over 20 years ago, but you will get Michael's high resolution photos that look way better in the same place, which was kind of creepy and very cool to see on the video. I'm like, oh, I've been there. Oh, I've walked there. Oh, I saw where I sat. So it's very, very cool. Do want to encourage you go and get that book. Michael, are there any other notes that you have for folks about some of the things in this video or your book?
Oh, wow. Archaeology, I describe it, it is a science, but a lot of it is an art. And especially when we get to interpreting the archaeological record, it does become an art form, really. And there are many interpretations, and I recognize that. And want to be sure that I acknowledge that as well. But at the same time, archaeology does help us. And I think that becomes clear in the book. And I hope people will enjoy reading it as much as I enjoyed writing it.
Yes. As a friend who watched you through the process, y'all, he was giddy. He was quite giddy, and he could not wait to get this out into the world. So it was enjoyable for him. And now the baby has been birthed. Go and pick it up at Amazon or elsewhere online or in digital format. Michael, thank you for spending both time in that, as well as like letting us join in the excitement today on the podcast. If this is your first time listening to our podcast, there are other episodes within the series of Archaeology Meets Missiology, as well as many other things that we have talked about on the Ephesiology podcast. So please go to your podcast loader, see if there's a topic or a guest that we have had on that is of interest to you. Go and check that out. Or as Michael mentioned, when you talk about that free class, that free course, well, you can go find more courses at masterclasses.ephesiology.com. See if there is something of interest, of benefit to you, to people who are a part of your church. Take that next step in what God might be doing in, and then the desire of what he might want to do through you by what you access through our courses. So for Michael and myself, thank you for doing theology and community with us today on the Ephesiology Podcast.